From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. She's running, and she's running, and she's running, and she's running, too. Four women have entered the 2020 presidential race thus far. Elizabeth Warren, Tulsi Gabbard, Kristen Gillibrand, and Kamala Harris. All Democrats, all high profile, and of course they are running against President Donald Trump. And in a changed landscape for women in politics. But will their gender play a central role in their campaigns, and should it? Well, this hour on Point, a first look at the women leading the 2020 presidential field. And you can join us. What do you make of the female candidates thus far? Who's captured your attention? Do you think gender should play a role in how we choose our next president? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today from Washington is Lisa Lehrer, reporter for The New York Times, who covers campaigns, elections, and political power. Before joining The New York Times, she was national political writer at the Associated Press, where she was lead reporter for the 2016 presidential race covering Hillary Clinton's campaign. Lisa Lehrer, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've written really interesting articles about how female candidates and the narrative surrounding them are shaping up thus far. Can you just tell us a little bit, a sense as to how people are seeing, you know, these now four women candidates who've entered the field?
Well, look, this is historic and it's unprecedented. For a really long time, Hillary Clinton was really the one and only woman that Americans saw compete on the presidential stage. And now you have not one, but four candidates with the possibility of getting up to five or six, depending who jumps in, who does or does not jump into the race in the coming weeks and months. So the country has just never seen a race like this. And I think Hillary Clinton is somewhat unique in that her gender is really intermixed with a lot of other things. She's been on the national stage for decades and decades. So she comes with a lot of background and baggage from her time in her husband's administration in the 90s, from her time as New York senator, whereas a lot of the women running now are fresher faces. So this is going to be a really interesting race. And I mean, no one knows exactly how any of this is going to play out. We know that gender certainly will be an issue. It's hard to imagine it won't be. In part because the presence of so many women in the race, but also in part because President Donald Trump, who made gender such a centerpiece of his presidential campaign and who, you know, has been willing to use Twitter to talk about women in some fairly graphic and personal ways. So it's hard to imagine him sitting out the primary contest. So it's going to be fascinating to see how this all plays out over the coming months and year.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about how some of the of these candidates are specifically talking about the fact that they're women running. So first of all, let's hear a bit of tape here. This is Democratic Senator Kamala Harris of California. She announced her presidential bid yesterday. And on ABC's Good Morning America, in an interview for the show, she offered advice to young women.
There are going to be many times when you're going to be the only one like you in a room. And the thing I want you to remember is this. When you are in that room, we are all in that room with you, cheering you on. So chin up, shoulders back, and you use your voice and you speak for all of the people who are so proud you are in that room and want their voice to be projected through you.
That's Democratic Senator Kamala Harris. Lisa, in that cut, or how Harris specifically thus far, I mean, in the day since she's announced, has talked about her ambitions, how much is, you talked about how Hillary Clinton shaped the role that women are playing in the Democratic Party for so long. Do you hear Harris pushing past that role, or is talking about the fact that she's a woman still very central and very important?
Well, look, I think Hillary Clinton has this tortured history with how she talks about gender in presidential races. Of course, when she ran in 2008, she largely shied away from it, from talking about her historic first, as the first, you know, she would have been the first woman president, ceding that ground really to Barack Obama. In 2016, she embraced that a lot more and would talk about, you know, one of her most successful lines in her campaign speech was when Donald Trump had accused her of playing the women's card. And she famously said, "If that's playing the women's card, deal me in." So she embraced that much more the second time around. I don't think you'll see any of the candidates this time around shying away from their gender. I think it's something they're all sort of embracing, some more than others. Kirsten Gillibrand has really made it a centerpiece of her campaign. She's been someone that's been working on electing more women to political office for quite some time. Kamala Harris, as you heard in that clip, is talking about it pretty aggressively. But I don't think any of the candidates will do quite what Hillary Clinton did. I think they all see it as an asset, and that's in part because of the midterms. I mean,
right.
You had these midterm races where women not only won elected office in historic numbers, but they also powered much of the party's gains.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you, they're not talking about it as centrally because they don't have to necessarily. Yeah.
Right. But the in 2018, women were the volunteers. They were the campaign managers. There were these big women's marches, and that really fueled this the so-called, resistance to President Trump. And women have been at the forefront of that movement. So all these candidates are fighting over that vote and trying to capture some of that energy that really powered Democrats' ability to take control of the House in 2018. So I don't think you'll see any of them shying away from it. The question is whether it becomes an issue in some way.
Mm. Well, you talked about Kirsten Gillibrand, so let's listen to her, Democratic senator. She's 52 years old. She announced her campaign on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
Well, I'm going to run for president of the United States because as a young mom, I'm going to fight for other people's kids as hard as I would fight for my own.
That's Senator Kirsten Gillibrand on Stephen Colbert's show. And I mentioned her age only because some people took exception to her saying that she's a young mom. But Lisa Lehrer, let me ask you, I'm wondering how it is that or how the Democratic Party itself sees this group of powerful women running for the presidency right now. Does the part... And it's not a monolith, but does the party itself, from your reporting, see itself ready as putting forth a woman as a nominee again?
So we actually did a really interesting piece on this a couple weeks ago where we talked to dozens of Democrats, everyone from DNC officials to average voters in a mall in Pennsylvania kind of thing. And there is a little bit of a divide. There are certainly a number of people who say, look, women are a major force in the party. Women powered these 2018 gains, as we were talking about, and they deserve representation in the highest levels, and that is the White House. But then there's another quieter subset of Democrats who are just really worried about this. And some of that, some of those people are people who were really strong Hillary Clinton supporters who sort of feel like, well, if Hillary Clinton can't do it, how could somebody else do it? Some of that group are people who just really want to beat President Donald Trump and are worried because there's been this greater acknowledgement of the kinds of sexism women face when running for president, running for president and other political offices, that their gender could hurt them. And they would argue that that's something the Democratic Party can't afford when there's so much they feel on the line with beating President Trump. But that part of the party is a much quieter conversation. Mm. When you talk to voters, you hear a lot of things like, well, I would never say that. I don't think a woman can win, but I've heard some of my friends say that, which is, that's how voters talk about issues like this. That's something we heard a lot when President Barack Obama was first winning. So what people working on these presidential campaigns for these female candidates will say is that you have to prove that they can do it. You have a woman that wins Iowa, then all of a sudden, like happened with President Obama, a lot of these people will get behind her and say, well, this is something that can happen, that these candidates seem strong.
Yeah.
I also think having so many female candidates in the field could help normalize some of this
mm-hmm.
stuff, could help normalize women's political ambition and allow those candidates to be sort of individuals and to be assessed based on their platforms rather than just their gender. The gender, as you were sort of alluding to before, is one piece in a larger profile of the candidate rather than the dominant piece.
Right. Well, joining us now from Washington is Celinda Lake. She's a longtime Democratic pollster and expert on women voters. She's a founder and president of Lake Research Partners, a political strategy firm, and also author of What Women Really Want, How American Women Are Quietly Erasing Political, Racial, Class, and Religious Lines to Change the Way We Live. She co-wrote that with Kellyanne Conway in 2005. Celinda Lake, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
So your first thoughts on these four thus far Democratic women who've jumped into the field?
Well, I think Lisa made a lot of really important points, and it's great to be on with you, Lisa, too. I would say a couple of things. First of all, let's remember that the Democratic primary is 59% female. Mm. So we have our base is women voters, and our swing is women voters. So it's very, very important that we have all of these women running. We know from the work that the Barbara Lee Family Foundation and others have done that it is different, however, to run for legislative office than executive office. And in fact, even though we elected historic numbers of governors, we had more candidates defeated running for governor than running for Congress, where being a woman was the ticket in 2016 or 2018. So I think we need to remember that it is more difficult for women to succeed in solo office and executive office, and you see some of that playing out. I really think the most important thing that's been said on this show so far, though, is what Lisa said about having so many women normalizes mm-hmm. it. And Madeline Cunin, in her book, wrote, the first woman governor elected in her own right, wrote about this a while ago, that it is very dangerous and damaging to be exceptional. And that now what's great about, we have women running, talking to young women. We have running women running, talking to Wall Street. We have women running, talking to mothers. We have women who share all kinds of experience, lawyers, teachers, bankers. And so I think what's really great about this, if you don't like the tall woman, you have a short one. If you don't like the blonde, you have a brunette.
Well, Celinda Lake and Lisa Lehrer, stand by here for just a second because I want to pick up that thought when we come back from a quick break. We're talking about the four thus far Democratic women who have tossed their hats into the ring for the 2020 presidential race. What do you make of the fact that we have four already? Is it normalizing women seeking the highest office in the land, as both Celinda Lake and Lisa Lehrer have said? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the fact that already there are four Democratic women who have decided to run for president of the United States. There could be more on the horizon, and what that means for women in politics after the 2018 midterms and as we look forward towards the 2020 presidential election. I'm joined today by Lisa Lehrer. She's a reporter at the New York Times covering campaigns, elections, and political power. Also with us is Celinda Lake. She's a longtime Democratic pollster and an expert on women's votes and female voters as well. They're both with us from Washington. Let's just listen to a moment to Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat of Massachusetts. She, of course, was the first woman to throw her hat into the ring. Earlier this month, she was on MSNBC's Rachel Maddow show when she talked about building on the momentum of female candidates that won during that 2018 midterm election.
Look at all the women who said, never thought I was going to be called on to do this, but they stood up and they said, I'm part of this. This is my country. My voice will be heard and my government will reflect my values. That's what I believe. And I think the best place to fight that is right there from the presidency of the United States of America.
Senator Elizabeth Warren there a little earlier this month. Celinda and Lisa, you both, before the break, were talking about how the fact that this large number of women running is beginning to normalize females, women seeking the presidency of the United States. And I have to say, I see what you're saying, and that may be true during the primary process, for example. But once, you know, say a woman gets through and becomes a Democratic nominee, there's still, does that normalization effect still hold in the general election, Celinda?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that's going to normalize things in the general election, and there will be a star and an excitement factor. But again, I think you have to remember the Democrats would unite behind Dennis the Menace or Denise Menace if she could beat Donald Trump. So we're going to be plenty excited anyway. But I think that there are two things that will matter. One, the ability of a woman to mobilize other women voters. And that's going to be very key for 2020. And the second thing I think that's going to be very important is one of the things that really hampered Hillary Clinton, and I think Lisa was exactly right. She's a very unique candidate, mm-hmm. as much Clinton as woman, honestly. But what is good about what's happening here is that these women will have come through a tough process where they've showed strength, they've showed resilience, and where their message about being a woman and the experience of woman is incorporated into their broader message. It's not just identity politics. It's about being in touch. It's about being uncorruptible. It's about being change-oriented. And I think one of the things that got lost in 2016 was being the woman candidate became just about identity politics rather than the broader set of experiences and perspectives that women bring.
Mm. Lisa, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Celinda makes some really good points and, of course, is right. But I do think there's another dynamic here, which is President Trump. And Democrats haven't solved the mystery of how to, you know, the best way of to go after President Trump. And part of what you'll see in the primary process is people testing out different tactics. You know, in the midterms, the congressional candidates largely ignored the president and tried to focus on their agenda, specifically health care, and that worked for them. But a presidential race is totally different than running for Congress in every way, pretty much. So I think Democrats need to figure out how to go after Trump. And for women, that may be slightly different than for men, just because the president has an ability to put gender so front and center. At least that's what he did in the 2016 race. You know, it was just back and forth with charges of sexual mm-hmm. assault and harassment and sort of gender-infused attacks. And there's really no reason to suspect that he would run differently against a woman this time around. So the question is, does a woman run differently against him? And I think the answer to that clearly will be yes. We just don't know what that's going to look like
right.
yet.
But of course, I mean, we should remember that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, right, by 3 million votes or so. So how, I mean, how different, again, the particular complexities and baggage that Hillary Clinton has aside, I mean, how differently should, Celinda, let me turn this to you, should a female candidate, if she becomes the nominee, you know, run against President Trump on this issue of how he treats women and issues of gender?
Well, I think the country has been exposed to him and his style for 4 years, and I think they're in a different mood. And I think the things that they both saw as, well, he's different, he's changed, and we want that, or the things that were like, he's not that experienced, he's a businessman, so we're going to let it go, I think have worn very thin with the public. It has particularly worn thin with women voters. And there's a big gap between college-educated and non-college-educated women, particularly white women. So women of color and college-educated women have had it. And they are going to be responsive to one style of critique. Non-college-educated white women, who actually are very upset by the shutdown, for example, it may be a different kind of campaigning. But I don't think all of these women will run against Donald Trump in the same way. The good thing about having so many choices is each of these candidates is going to run in a different way against Donald Trump. And may, you know, a thousand flowers bloom. That's great.
Well, I want to actually play, since you mentioned about how these candidates might approach running against the president, let's play a couple of clips here of some of the senators responding to questions about President Trump. First of all, over the weekend, CNN's Jake Tapper asked Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand about her past comments on immigration. And previously she had said she opposes, quote, amnesty for illegal aliens and that, quote, English should be made the official language of the United States. She said she's evolved in her thinking from that point and those positions were unkind. But then Jake Tapper pressed her further.
So what's the difference, though? Just help me understand between your previous positions, which you characterize as wrong and not empathetic, and President Trump's positions today that you call racist.
So what President Trump is doing is creating fear and division and a darkness across this country that I've never seen before. One of the reasons I'm running for president, Jake, is because we have to restore that integrity to our presidency, to this country. We have always been a compassionate country. We have always cared about others. We've always believed in the golden rule. And what President Trump is doing is destroying the moral fabric of what this country stands for.
That's Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Now, in a press conference just after she announced she was running for president, Democratic Senator Kamala Harris was asked why she thinks she's the most capable Democrat, the strongest Democrat, to beat President Trump. And here's how she responded.
I love my country. And I feel a sense of responsibility to stand up and fight for the best of who we are. And I'm prepared to fight, and I know how to fight. And in particular, when we're talking about fighting for the values that we hold sacred and dear, when it comes to talking about how we fight for the American people and have leadership in this country that is focused on the needs of the people instead of self-interest, I'm prepared to fight that way. And I believe it will be a winning fight.
Celinda Lake, what differences do you hear in those two responses?
Really, really interesting differences. So one is a softer style, one is a stronger style. What I think is really interesting is that each of these women, strength is one of the hardest characteristics for women to show and for voters to still like them and be comfortable. And what's really interesting to me is each of these women is positioning themselves as a fighter in a different way. Senator Harris, as you just heard, being prepared to fight in kind of an almost lawyer Kavanaugh type approach. Senator Gillibrand talking about the fighting as a lioness, as a mother would fight, but a softer style. Senator Warren talking about a populist kind of fighter. So one of the things you see is each of these women demonstrating their own personal authentic style, their different approaches to being a fighter. And similarly, I think they will have different approaches to taking on Donald Trump.
Well, let's go to the callers here. Lots of them want to join us. Let's get one in at least. Belle is calling from Tucson, Arizona. Belle, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I wanted to bring up what I consider the most pivotal and biggest factor in this whole discussion is that if we as a country don't discuss and address the reality of prevailing misogyny, all of this talk about possibly seeing a woman in high office is just fluff. It's going to be a long time before we see somebody as experienced or as knowledgeable as Hillary Clinton. And if we took her resume and slapped the name Joe Johnson on top, Joe would probably be president right now. Mm. We really don't seem to be willing to accept. You know, I talk to a lot of my millennial neighbors. I'm over 60, and I'm also a retired Fed. And I talk to my millennial and teenage female relatives and neighbors, and they all seem to default very quickly to Joe Biden as their preferred, as the person they think is going to win the Democratic nomination. I myself, I'm independent, and I vote both sides of the ticket. I'm thinking Kamala Harris looks honestly like the stronger candidate. Cortez is a very well-spoken person who's going to win people over emotionally. And Gillibrand comes off as being hypocritical and kind of 1950s in modern clothing.
Yeah.
Kind of.
But Belle, I hear what you're saying about confronting the issue, just the basic issue of misogyny in American politics that any female candidate has to face, and perhaps it's extremely heightened in the presidential race. So let me, Belle, thank you for your call. Let me turn that to Lisa Lehrer, because Lisa, you followed Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. I mean, I don't think we have talked enough about if and at what point in time just misogyny comes into play in terms of what a female presidential candidate has to face.
Well, I think there's a much more active conversation now happening about that than there was certainly in 2007 when Hillary Clinton was running for the first time. And even then in 2016 when she ran again, I do get from voters when you talk to them, just like, you know, the last caller, a greater awareness of the kinds of barriers that female candidates face and a greater willingness to jump on what they see as sexism. You know, this is the first presidential race we'll be having in the Me Too era or the post-Me Too era. And there has been a lot more outspokenness about these kinds of this kind of structural and institutional sexism, I think, during the Trump administration. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. And if things like, you know, his treatment of Anita Hill during the Supreme Court confirmation hearings come back to haunt Joe Biden mm-hmm. in a presidential race. Just to see how some of these things play out in the time period we're in now will be pretty fascinating.
So, Linda, I just want to get a quick response from you on that. What do you think?
I think the caller raises a really good point. I think misogyny, like racism, is going to be around with us for a very long time. But I think any campaign that doesn't address both racism and misogyny is, one, not going to beat Donald Trump, and two, not going to speak to where the massive numbers of voters are. This country is ready for a very profound change. People are changing their attitudes very rapidly, and we can't beat Donald Trump without dealing with both racism and misogyny.
Well, Celinda and Kim, hang on. Celinda and Lisa, excuse me, hang on here for just a second because I want to turn to Kim Alfano. She's joining us via Skype from Landenburg, Pennsylvania. She's a Republican strategist and president and CEO of Alfano Communications. And we wanted to invite Kim into the conversation to talk about how these candidates need to speak to all Americans. So, Kim, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's really great.
Hello, everybody.
It's great to have you, Kim. And as I said, you know, if, and of course, these are all big ifs, we're 20 months out from 2020, but and the election in 2020. But if one of these women, say, becomes the Democratic nominee, I mean, what's your view on the field so far and how they need to speak to all Americans as they run for president?
Well, the field so far is large and only going to get larger and larger and larger. So that's one thing to consider. And I'm no doubt we're going to have many women candidates running against Donald Trump, and we should. What notably, though, now we don't have many female governors. Celinda was talking about the difference between running as an executive officer and running as a legislative officer, and she's absolutely right. Most of our presidents over the years have been picked from executive offices, not legislative offices. In mm-hmm. fact, it's kind of a big hurdle. So while I think these early candidates are exciting, I'll be interested to see if there's a female governor that pops up out of that group to run or someone along those lines. I think they're going to have to learn how to run like Donald Trump ran. It's a new world order. They don't have to be him. They certainly don't have to have his personality. But there's some lessons to be learned from Donald Trump. You know, he was a raw version of himself with no, you know, unabashedly raw about who he was. And you could like it or hate it, but he was who he was. People running against him need to learn that they can't be smooth. They can't be poll driven. They can't be political even. They have to run as, you know, reality TV, real human beings this time around. Mm. I think the era of consultants is kind of we need to go to the background, I think, at this point. And we have to sort of learn how to let our candidates be our candidates.
Kim, are you, you're advocating yourself out of a job here, but
no, because you know, the only upside of 2018 is there's going to be a lot more Republican challengers next cycle. So I think I'm going to find work.
Well, but let me, can I just get, I want to hear what Celinda Lake has to say about what you just said, Kim, because Celinda, I hear Kim saying authenticity is really the underlying message here. And does that work for women? I mean, I think just politics aside, even women in the workplace, there's endless discussions about when their authentic selves, they get pushed back. That must only... You laugh, but you know I'm deadly serious.
I know
serious.
I'm right. I thought between Kim hitting pollsters here and we can't be who we are.
Does that work for women in politics?
It is hard. I think that Kim is right about authenticity. I do think that women have to juggle more this issue of proving that they're qualified for executive office and maintaining their likability. So there's still, I think, a bit of a double bind. There's still a narrower standard here. One of the problems that women have is when they are the only one running, all of these things really take on a disproportionate impact and disproportionate saliency. And if a woman makes a mistake, it's like, oh, my God, I was worried she couldn't handle it, even someone as qualified as Hillary Clinton. So I think what's really great about all of these women is it's going to mute that factor. Okay, so you don't like that woman. How about this kind of woman? You don't think this woman's qualified. How about this background? The other thing I want to say real quickly about what Kim mentioned about women governors, we just don't have that many senior women governors, but we do have women governors in some key states that Democrats have to win, Iowa and Michigan, where it's a Republican and Democratic governor.
Right. Well, and you know what? Looking forward to 2024, there's a particular former South Carolina governor I'm thinking of, that a Republican that perhaps a lot of people wonder may eventually aim for the White House. But Celinda Lake, Lisa Lira, and Kim Alfano, hang on here for just a second. We got to take a quick break. We'll come right back. We're talking this hour about the four thus far Democratic women who are running for president of the United States and whether or not we're at a turning point regarding women seeking the highest office in the land. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered, but we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the four thus far female candidates who have thrown their hats into the ring for the presidency of the United States in the 2020 presidential election. I'm joined today by Lisa Lehrer. She's reporter for The New York Times, covering campaigns, elections, and political power. Kim Alfano also joins us. She's a Republican strategist and president and CEO of Alfano Communications. And Celinda Lake is with us. She's a longtime Democratic pollster and expert on women voters, founder and president of Lake Research Partners. And Celinda, I know that we've got to let you go here in just a minute, so I just want to ask you one more quick question before you slip out of the studio there.
Thank you.
I'm also wondering about the, since we're focusing on the Democrats at the moment, there's been some changes in the primary schedule, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like California, giant state, has moved way up into March now, early March. What difference does that make, if at all, for any of these women candidates?
Oh, I think it makes a huge difference, and it provides a lot more opportunities. And besides California moving up, California will start its early vote process before the Iowa caucuses have voted, which is just unprecedented. The other thing is we don't have the superdelegates anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So this early primary, this variety of different kinds of places allow, I think, a number of different women and different kinds of candidates to emerge in different places.
Right.
And a number of people who have kind of home bases or states right next to their home bases that could make a very prominent early showing for them.
Well, and a lot of these states have also shown, at least at the federal level or even at the state level, their governors and senators and House representatives,
yes,
to show they've shown no compunction in terms of electing women.
Right. And some of these states, like New Hampshire, California, Nevada, they really like women. So these are good states for these women candidates to be going into. It used to be a much, much tougher schedule for a woman. And I think it allows for a number of upsets as well.
Well, Celinda Lake, Democratic pollster and expert on women's voters and founder and president of Lake Research Partners. Thank you so much for joining us, Celinda.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Brando, who's calling from Toronto, Canada. Brando, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I think everyone is making a mistake. I'd like to respectfully point out these women are not running against Trump. They're running against each other. And people will look at qualifications. Now, I know they're all in the Senate, and historically in the last 100 years, two people have gone from the Senate to the Oval Office directly. So there's going to have to be a little bit more meat on the bone for them to win a general election if they consider the fact that they are a woman as a qualification. There are people out there, I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, it's just a thing, but I think voters who would consider being a woman a qualification, they had their chance with Hillary. And she was the most qualified ever. She was running against the most disliked ever, an admitted sexual abuser, and she couldn't even do it. And what has changed since then is the Me Too movement, and I think that's the elephant in the room, and how that's going to affect men with, you know, the Gillette ad and the prevailing imagery that's coming through the media. I'd like your guests to address that.
Well, Brando, don't hang up here just a second, because I want to ask you a quick question. I hear you saying that you don't think that gender should be, you know, a reason or a qualification. Oh, he's hung up. Okay, well, darn it, Brando. But Lisa Lair, let me turn to you, because what I was going to ask Brando was, we've got a different comment online that's come in from someone calling themselves Hello Kitty, who says, gender has been a barrier to overcome. Should it be part of a campaign? Obviously not. But since it determines so much in society, for better or worse, how could it not be part of a campaign? So, Lisa, what do you think?
I mean, I guess I agree with Hello Kitty. These candidates are women. It's hard to separate that out. They're not going to be women because they're running for president. So that's something that is going to be discussed, that's going to be analyzed, that's going to be focused on. I think what you'll see with all of them is sort of embracing that and leaning into it as another point of experience. Is it a qualification? I mean, I don't think gender is really a qualification, but I think it's part of their experience and part of their experience that they will use, like all candidates use, to win over voters, to try to relate to people. As for Hillary Clinton being the most qualified, that's something you hear a lot from voters. Well, if Hillary couldn't do it, no other female candidate can ever possibly do it. But, you know, as we said earlier in the show, it's really hard to separate Hillary Clinton's gender from a lot of the other things about her, a lot of her other baggage. She was someone who was running with a very long record in Washington at a time when clearly people wanted something new. They wanted to shake up the system. And in a lot of ways, Hillary Clinton was the system. And it was really difficult for her to overcome that image because, in fact, there was some truth to it. She had been in Washington for decades. So I think it's really hard to unpack those various things when you start talking about Hillary Clinton and using her as a template for what's to come.
Right. Well, Kim Alfano, what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I agree and I disagree. I agree that, you know, you're a woman, you're going to run from the perspective of a woman. But, you know, because it's becoming normalized, because there'll be so many contenders in this race, it's really not going to have the impact that it would have if you were the only woman running. Hillary Clinton's issue, I mean, if you remember, at one point she was actually scolding women for not, you know, supporting her campaign. And because she was a woman, and that really makes us into a monolith. Women are not a monolith. Mm-hmm. We care about economic issues. We care about education issues. We care about crime. We care about every single same thing that a man would care about. And I think if you run as a woman too much, if that's too central to who you are and what your campaign is about, you're going to miss out on talking to those Wisconsin voters that didn't vote for Hillary, those Pennsylvania suburban moms that are, you know, that contrary to what the press would paint a Trump voter, are well-educated and thoughtful and just wanted something that was not of Washington. I mean, I think that you make a big mistake running as a woman or just selecting a candidate or covering one as a woman.
Yeah. Well, so Kim, let me ask you a question. This is something that actually I want to know what both you and Lisa think, because of course I still can't get over the fact that the United States hasn't yet elected a woman to the White House of any party, right? Not thinking just Democrats, but obviously Democrats or Republicans or even a third party, you know, whereas many, many other nations around the world have had strong female leaders. Now, most of those other nations, as far as I can tell, say they have parliamentary systems, or at least many of them do. So the whole means of electing a leader there is different. You're sort of campaigning to the members of your party, not directly to voters, as candidates here in the United States have to do. So, Kim, is there something particular about the way Americans choose their president that's made it more challenging for women?
Well, I think our primary system makes it challenging for someone to have crossover appeal that's new and different. Barack Obama figured out a way to have that crossover appeal. But I think that for women, it's hard because if you want to win your Democratic primary, you have to sort of embrace the most progressive and the most liberal ideas in your party. Just as a Republican, you have to go to the right. But then when you come back and try to appeal to, again, that Midwestern voter, that sort of down to earth, middle of the road kind of voter, it's hard to rebrand yourself. So I don't think it's necessarily just for women. It's for most candidates. But for women, it's a little harder to rebrand yourself because it's so hard to brand yourself in the first place.
Right. Lisa, what do you think?
Well, I think part of what's happening is the way women are running has changed. You know, for a really long time, we didn't see female candidates with young children. Mostly, you know, women ran like Nancy Pelosi or, you know, even Elizabeth Warren once their children were grown and out of the house. So, you know, that meant that you had to be sort of older to run. And there weren't as many women who were older who were in the mix to run. The Democrats haven't had such an open primary for so long. So I think some of it is the system and some of it is just how things have sort of shaken out over the past couple of years and how women ran. Women, we know from research, are less likely to run without having the party's blessing. That changed this past midterm cycle where you saw a lot of women make bids, you know, make primary contests and run against the party. So some of these things are shifting, but I think there were a lot of things in our culture of politics beyond just the system of politics that made it more difficult for women.
And since you spent so long, you know, talking to voters and following the Clinton campaign in 2016, let me ask you this also. And I have no idea if this is true or not, but I wonder if also when push comes to shove, and maybe this is something voters don't actually want to say out loud, but the president of the United States is also the commander in chief. And I wonder if there's a possibility that some voters out there still have trouble seeing a woman as commander in chief. Or does that not apply anymore? Because, again, I just point to 3 million more popular votes for Hillary Clinton.
Well, I mean, we know, as I think Celinda or somebody early in the program pointed out, that it is harder for women to win these executive roles. It's easier for them to win sort of the congressional legislative role. So I think there is a piece of that. But, you know, that is changing. And a lot of the women who ran and won successfully in the midterms were veterans, were, you know, fighter pilots and things like that. So not all of them won, but a lot ran and a number won. So I think some of those expectations are shifting.
Definitely changing. Well, let's go to Diane, who's calling from Davenport, Iowa. Diane, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to point out that I live in a progressive part of the state, not Steve King country. And what I hear here is that integrity is at the top of the list of a candidate that people want. So far, Kamala Harris strikes what I think is a nice balance for lots of reasons. Elizabeth Warren as well. Hildebrand, not so much. Six-year term that she didn't finish. And I am definitely a supporter of the Me Too movement. But how she handled Al Franken was, in my opinion, a disgrace. Having said that, the top issues, I believe, are health care and also young families. So you've got two ends of the spectrum. That's why I think the real combination, should it happen, I'd be thrilled. And I don't care who's first and who's second, is Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris.
Well, Diane, let me take it back from you. Thank you so much for your call there. Diane from Davenport, Iowa. Let's go to Ben, who's calling from Austin, Texas. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make the point that I think that it's completely possible for a woman to win this next election. I think it's just very important that she is a unifying person for independents and somebody who can bring in even conservatives. I think the problem that Hillary Clinton had was that she didn't seem authentic and she disenfranchised a lot of Bernie Sanders voters and independents who otherwise would have come to the polls that day. And I think someone like Tulsi Gabbard could really do a good job at that. Also, I think Elizabeth Warren would be good. It has to be a very strong economic message that can get the Rust Belt to vote for her, strong on issues like NAFTA and trade agreements. Mm. So that's just the point that I wanted to make.
Well, Ben, thank you for your call. Kim Alfano, let me turn back to you. You hear Ben there saying that any candidate has to reach – Democratic candidate has to also appeal to a key number of independent voters.
I would agree wholeheartedly. Even those sort of what were blue dog Democrats that are now Reagan Republicans that may even be on the fringes of Trump America, those people who, you know, every day have to worry about their job security, their 401k, how is the stock market doing? You know, these are, like I say, universal issues versus party issues. And, you know, parties have become less and less important in many races, except the presidential race, where, again, we have to do this massive primary that appeals to only our own party. It kind of handicaps us across the way. But if you are a Democrat and you're running for president in 2020, you certainly have to address the economy. If the economy is going well, you have to not mess it up. If the economy has for some reason taken a turn, then you have to figure out how you're going to assure those people their job security, their, you know, their healthcare is among part of that for the Democratic primary. But these are just real life issues, and they don't have Kamala Harris said something pretty interesting on Morning Joe the other day. When you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you don't ever think about your political party. You think about, you know, the health of your family and how your paycheck is going to be distributed that day. Are you going to have that job for a while? And I thought, you know, that kind of rhetoric that we're a lot more alike than apart rhetoric, I think may be the hopeful appeal. Counter to what Donald Trump said, which was, I get what you're going through. He got people to believe that he was like them. And even though he was dramatically different, he spoke to a core of, you know, worried voters about things that mattered to them, jobs and the economy and, you know, just preservation of their way of life. And it's evolved as he's been president, but he touched a button. You know, that Democrats are going to have to figure out how to do the same for some of the same voters.
Well, you know, since our caller Ben there from Austin, Texas mentioned Tulsi Gabbard, I just want to play a little bit of tape from her because, of course, the Hawaii Democratic Congresswoman she's one of the four women who've announced her run for presidency. In an interview with CNN earlier this month, when she announced her intention to run, she said one particular issue would be at the center of her campaign.
There's a whole host of issues that I'm looking forward to addressing, and there is one main issue that is central to the rest, and that is the issue of war and peace.
And I should note that Gabbard is also a veteran of the Iraq War, but she drew a lot of backlash in 2017 when she traveled to Syria and personally met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Lisa Lehrer, we've got about a minute left to go here, and obviously we've been talking about women running, but going back to the Democratic Party, since all of these candidates are currently the female candidates that have announced are currently all Democratic, does the party have a bigger issue in terms of managing the split that emerged in 2016 between the Clinton wing and the other wings of the party, and does that split still play a role in how it wants to move forward?
Well, that's part of what the primary process is going to resolve, what the Democratic Party is and what it stands for in the Trump era. I think there are definitely different strains within the party, and you'll see that different candidates will sort of come out, and we like to call them lanes or whatever in, you know, political speak. But I think that's part of what we'll see in this primary process.
Yeah. Well, and I have to apologize to everyone. I just had like one of those live radio moments. The Sanders wing is what I was going to say. That's how you know it's live, when I forget the name of a key American politician like Bernie Sanders. So my apologies to everybody. But Lisa Lehrer, reporter at the New York Times, covering campaigns, elections, and political power, thank you so much for joining us, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
And Kim Alfano, Republican strategist and president and CEO of Alfano Communications. It was great to have you, Kim. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.